This is the World Retail Podcast, the premier platform for global retail leaders, where vision meets insight and innovation takes center stage. From AI to embedded finance, leadership to the ever-evolving consumer, we bring you the voices shaping the future of retail. World Retail Podcast, your front row seat to retail's next chapter.
Hello and welcome to the World Retail Podcast. My name is Ian McGarrigle and I'm the founder and chair of the World Retail Congress. This episode is part of our special series of podcasts produced in partnership with the global retail team at Deloitte. This series is focused on one of the most important drivers of retail success, and that is the customer. Over six episodes, we will bring you high-level interviews with some top retail leaders to learn more about how they are focused on the customer. Today's interview is with one of Europe's leading grocery retailers, Albert Heijn, which is also part of Ahold Delhaize, which operates across North America, Europe and Indonesia with close to 9,500 stores and a portfolio of 17 brands. We were delighted to be able to talk to Albert Heijn's SVP of Strategy, Data and IT, Sjoerd Holleman. Sjoerd also took part in a main stage panel at this year's World Retail Congress. I was joined for this special interview by Adgild Hop, Retail Market Lead North-South Europe and Consumer Consulting Lead Netherlands at Deloitte. I very much hope you enjoyed this episode with Adgild and I in conversation with Sjoerd Holleman. Hi Adgild, and thank you for joining me for this episode for the World Retail Podcast. How are you today?
My pleasure. Yeah, really good. Happy to be here.
Good. So Sjoerd was a panelist, of course, as you know, at the World Retail Congress with Deloitte, and it was a great session. So to start us off, I'd love to get your thoughts on what you're looking to build on, because there was a lot talked about in that session, and I know you're keen to sort of dive a bit deeper into some of the things that came out.
For sure. So for me, I think there were two key themes. One, just understanding in particular this Gen Z, Gen Alpha consumer, and how they are different. Is one of the things that I just find really fascinating, and the second is probably more the how of the transformation, mainly around the culture side of things, the leadership side of things.
Yeah. No, as I say, it was a great session at the Congress, so I think there's going to be lots for us to talk about. So I think without further ado, we should bring in and welcome Sjoerd Holleman. Sjoerd, how are you? Great to see you.
Thank you. Yeah, good to see you, and thanks for the invite. It'd be nice to share some views together.
Yeah. Sjoerd, you are responsible for strategy, data and IT at Albert Heijn. This must give you a very deep understanding of the extraordinary number of customers the group serves every day.
I mean, the Dutch market is a very competitive grocery market and a lot of innovative players. So it gives me a lot of insight. And we have many customers that we can learn from on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Well, looking forward to this conversation. So Adgild, over to you.
Thanks, Ian. So Albert Heijn, I think, is really quite impressive in that it is, you know, the largest player in what is a very competitive market. And what I guess one of the challenges, sort of, that you guys have is needing to cater to quite a wide base of consumer preferences. I was quite intrigued about the Gen Z and the Gen Alpha kind of rising up and becoming more important. Do you see them like actively shopping differently? Are you buying different products, or using different channels and so on? And can you share something about that?
Yeah, I can share some. What we clearly see is that the Gen Z and partly Gen Alpha, even though they're somewhat younger, actually are visiting our stores more than ever. So from a grocery retail. Now, that might be part related to Albert Heijn having so many stores in what is a relatively small country. But I think the vicinity of our stores, but also the behavior of the Gen Z customer, we see them come to the store often, frequent a lot, and is actually one of our fastest growing demographics in our stores, which is something that might be counterintuitive, because everybody's talking the world's becoming more digital, everybody's on their app, etc. Yes, they are, and they are using social quite a lot and are significantly looking for trends and inspiration on social. So sometimes I actually say they're more loyal to the trend than the brand and the brands they buy, because they're not that much of an A brand buyer in most cases, but they're much more of a trend buyer. So whatever's hip and happening on social and going on. I think I shared on stage also in the panel that I have a 17-year-old daughter that keeps me up to date on where we are doing well in terms of keeping up with the trends and where not. But we see a lot of store visits and a lot of focus on that from Gen Z. That might be counterintuitive because everybody thinks, well, they must be on their app and ordering everything online. Well, for food retail, that's not the case. And they're really frequenting our stores many times.
Any particular format that they favor? Is it the convenience store, the smaller stores, or?
No, I mean, our convenience stores, we have quite many on high traffic locations, but it's typically our average supermarket that are in close vicinity to many of the urban and suburban regions.
Right.
So I do find it really fascinating indeed, because you would have the cliche would be that they wouldn't get off their sofa, which clearly isn't true. So you guys, I think, are relatively advanced around the kind of offering self-scan, self-checkout through handheld, through mobiles, etc. Do you see different in-store use of those tools with the younger population?
Well, clearly their basket size is a lot smaller, so they wouldn't be using handheld that much, because they're clearly only there for small shops. But what you would expect, and the cliche there is true, is that they're very used to using the digital interfaces in store and all our self-scan, etc. So no explanation there necessary. But that might also be because, as we always say, so many of the Gen Z population in the Netherlands also works in our stores. So I think we have about 100,000 employees in our stores that are 15, 16, 17, 18 years old, and are actually also part of colleagues of mine in that sense. So they are very familiar with our stores. And our sort of business models also build up around many part-time workers instead of full-time workers. So in that sense, we sometimes have the statistics is 1 out of 4 or 1 out of 5 adults in the Netherlands has at one point in their life worked for Albert Heijn, which is sort of a unique metric there. But that's also because, yeah, many of the youngsters work in our store. So we keep, we're very close to them in many ways.
I may in the next year or two have to ask you for a favor, because I know that my 13-year-old son is scoping out the local Albert Heijn for maybe his first job.
He's more than welcome.
Yeah, I'll give him the coaching that I can. Maybe jumping to the other side of the spectrum then, one of the things that surprised me from the kind of Deloitte Global consumer study that we've done is just the rise of the 60-plus population, both number one in kind of number of consumers, but also the disposable income that they have and just the slightly different preferences that they've got. Anything you can share about the things that you're seeing in your business with and how you're catering to that population in particular?
Yeah, it's a completely different demographic there. So indeed, the disposable income is high. However, their households are typically smaller and even often one person or two person households. So yes, there is disposable income, but their need for groceries is in terms of volumes is lower. And they tend to be quite price sensitive and aware of what things cost and should cost. Whereas the Gen Z we just discussed, and just like my 17-year-old daughter, hasn't got much of a clue. It's just, I need it now, I want it now. But the older demographic, yes, the disposable income is higher, but they are very price conscious and also tend to shop around a little bit more for promotions, etc. Maybe because they have a little bit more time on their hands. But that,
yeah, exactly. Given that they've got more time in particular, I can imagine.
And in addition to that, what we see in terms of difference in their shopping behavior is they tend to be quite loyal to A brands and also A brands that are quite a little bit different than some of the other demographics. So one of the more of the older A brands, the brands that we all grew up with when living with our parents and et cetera, is typically their go-to. So they're not automatically drawn to own brand and not automatically drawn to new, more fancy A brands or sub brands coming up, but more of the traditional A brands that they've grown very loyal to.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And so with regards to this A brand versus private label versus smaller local brands, you see a lot of discussion around that. And there does appear to be a momentum away from the A brands towards private label and more local niche brands. If that's not coming from the 60 plus demographic, who's driving that in particular? Is it young families or is it?
Yeah, it's typically young families, millennials, and the anything in between the just sort of Gen Z and the elderly population is where we see also because families with young kids clearly they do spend more of their affordable income on groceries because yeah, especially as soon as kids get older and families get larger, the amount spent in our stores is clearly a lot higher. And own brand, they might not be as loyal to some of the older A brands. Clearly, always A brands are hugely important for us in store because they are there and they fulfill a great need. But on parallel to that, either on fresh but also on center store, our own brands have grown significantly over time, also in quality and in affordability, and which gives a nice balance for that whole income group.
It's clear. I think if you look at own brands, that you guys are indeed really quite advanced in that space. I was interested. I was in a grocery conference in Las Vegas, was it last year or something, and it was interesting how the US retailers were looking to Europe for inspiration around a shift to own brand, and they saw that as one of the next battlegrounds. Where my sense is for you guys, that's a journey that you've been on for quite a long time already.
Yeah, it's a journey that we've been on, and for I mean many years we use it both to both as a value alternative but also to a differentiating alternative. So clearly our time to market and our innovation is going more and more rapidly than ever before. And what we've also done is really embrace own brands. So it's not like a not so nice looking, lower quality alternative to an A brand, but it once was decades ago. It's now often of very good quality, very nice design, very something to be proud of. And we always say we need to be proud of every product we sell, no matter what the price, no matter in what area of the store, we need to be proud of every single product, both in the value we offer, but also the design and also the quality. So it's really core to what we want to be, and we're harvesting the fruits of that right now. That's what I said.
Really great to see. I guess clearly one of the underlying enablers, typically when people talk about private label, is affordability. As you mentioned, that's not always the main driver. If we just pivot to a slightly different question, then we as Deloitte asking consumers about how they felt about affordability versus health on the one hand, and then affordability versus sustainability on the other hand. And it was clear at that time that health was quite important and significantly more important, and that they were willing to spend more if they believed that it helped their health. Sustainability, on the other hand, was a matter of, yeah, it's really important. Yeah, other people need to fix it, but me as a consumer, not willing or able to spend much more to drive sustainable outcomes. Have you seen that shift at all in the last, let's say, 2 years, in particular, as the economy's tightened up and now with Trump?
Yeah, but I think we've always taken it on board as our responsibility to both deal with sustainability and offer the health alternative. So, I mean, in terms of as one of the things we always say as Albert Heijn, we want to be the trusted and inspiring partner. So trusted for the products need to be of good quality, good price level, but also have a look at salt, sugar, etc. I mean, of the necessarily healthy composition, but also inspiring, and basically inspiring bring something new that they might try. And we never want to be patronizing for people to try something that's a little bit more healthy for them or a little bit better for the planet for them. But we do want to inspire. So we try to inspire in all ways in order to help our customers at least make that transition or do a step in the other direction. For that little healthier or a little more sustainable, rather than, be patronizing, take away choice, etc. Because we get a lot of push on why don't you take away unhealthy choices or take away unsustainable offering. But yeah, it just doesn't work that way. I mean, we can't sort of be patronizing to our customers. We can be inspiring to our customers, and we really chose that path. And we've been quite successful also with, for example, the introduction of Albert Heijn Terra. So our full plant-based assortment. We have around 350 own brand articles now that are fully helping the protein transition and really making that a large alternative. And we tell people the recipes and things you can cook with it and how great it tastes. And we see being quite successful rather than we're taking away the other alternatives. So I think it's with food retail, it's always end-to-end. We never can have a choice to do or.
It's interesting what you're saying about sustainability because it came up a lot in the Congress, as you probably heard, not just in grocery but fashion, where there's frustration that consumers say one thing and do another. You know, they say they're supportive but don't necessarily follow that with what they buy, and yet we heard a number of retailers, and you've just made that point. You know, you have to do the right thing. You know, you have to stand by what your values are as a business.
And we also feel we're quite, I mean, we're clearly market leader in the Netherlands, but it comes with a huge responsibility, right? Also to lead the market. So in the past, we did it with chicken also, and we basically said, yeah, everybody having the same undesirable, maybe not so sustainable way of offering chicken to our customers. But we made that jump and made that sustainability jump, clearly increasing prices somewhat, but everybody else followed. And meanwhile, the whole of the market is now is selling a more sustainable chicken and doing the right thing. We always say internally, every day we fill 7 million plates in the Netherlands, and that comes with a responsibility, and that lies with us. So let's not wait for others to determine or legislations to come in or customers to do punishing us for that. Let's do the right thing.
One of the you will no doubt not remember this, but so you and I have known each other for years. And Ian, this is I think quite an interesting example. A couple of years ago, it must have been like 3 years ago, I think we were in a conversation, Sjoerd and I, about health and healthy living, and I distinctly remember Sjoerd you saying that you guys know the health benefits of parsnip, pastinaak, but you also know that consumers in the Netherlands don't tend to eat parsnip, but you know how healthy it is. And hence, you kind of told me that you guys made a conscious decision to incorporate parsnip a little bit as like a hidden ingredient in some of the home prepared meals. I thought, yeah, and that it really surprised me when you said that, because I thought it kind of underlined what you described, which is that you do feel a responsibility.
Yeah, and the same goes for the how many grams of fruits and veg people eat, and we know that there are still, I think, off the top of my head, 100 grams difference between what people should be eating in terms of fruit and veg every day and what they're actually eating in terms of what the so we're also looking at whether it's all our recipes or all our meals or any other thing we can do to inspire people to just add that little. So we made the cauliflower rice and the broccoli rice. It might taste a little bit different, but you have a lot of more vegetables you can eat. And just to be, yeah, as we said, if you do put out a poster or an ad and saying eat more vegetables and or we're gonna reduce meat in our stores and add more vegetables, people are not gonna change their behavior. But if you can inspire them to take that that new step and that new inspiration, then we are achieving our goals and their goals in the long run.
So we could talk about this for hours. Clearly, we can't. Maybe to jump a little bit away from what it is that our consumers consume to how they interact with you. And it's, you know, you can no doubt correct me, but I think in the Netherlands, online is now around 7% or something for I think for grocery, and it's about roughly around 10 in Europe. How far do you think online grocery in the Netherlands will go as a percentage of the market?
Yeah, I think that it's slightly difficult to say because we are a large part of that market. So we've doubled down even before Corona, we doubled down on our e-com capacity and e-com growth because we truly believe in the omni-channel approach. In the Netherlands, being e-commerce sales as a percentage of total sales for Albert Heijn being around 11%, approaching 12%, that we've doubled down our capacity for e-com growth since before Corona and ever since we've been expanding that and also adding mechanized home shop centers to fuel our further growth there. And not because we want e-com as a channel on itself to grow so much, as it does that all our data say that if our customers start shopping online, even though before they were shopping in store only, that their integral spending with us goes up by 40-42%. So customers become more loyal, the share of wallet of customers is increasing, and that really helps driving that customer loyalty and making them part of our network, but also getting first-party data and really learning how we can cater to them better. So we always want Albert Heijn to be, no matter where you are, whether you're in a small store, convenience store, shopping online, or et cetera, always being experienced the one Albert Heijn experience and really build loyalty that way. So that's is quite different than for some other players that we might know that have different proposition, different entities, et cetera. But we truly want that omni-channel experience. And we also see, for example, that we are bringing online stuff to offline. So on your hand scanners, if you're in a store, you can activate your personal offers that you'd normally get in your app when you're doing your shopping at home, et cetera. So what you see is that it becomes truly seamless omni-channel experience. And we still see in the Netherlands that those shoppers that shop e-com and do that every week still come to our stores 1 to 2 times a week. So it's really not like, oh, you've lost them and they're now an e-com customer. We hardly have any e-com only customers. We have many omni-channel customers that go through our network and interact with us at different points.
Do you think the fact that you've been investing in the app has been an important enabler to that? Because I remember you guys talking about, in essence, being mobile first for quite a while. Is that part of the glue that connects everything together?
Yeah, when we started out with our current strategy, which we drafted in 2019, 2020, we basically said we really want to have, if we go want to go app first, and everything we do, we want to digitalize, and the app is going to be in the pocket of everybody in the Netherlands, and this is going to be our centerpiece of interaction. And back in the day, we had about 200,000 users, and we've grew that to nearly 5 million active app users as we are right now. So it's really our vision of it becoming in the back pocket of every consumer in the Netherlands, etc., really came true. And what we did was we basically by what we did is we digitalized anything we done with our customers. So all our non-food saving campaigns, whether it's your loyalty points, whether it's your any other programs you had, everything was digital first. And step by step, we all put it in the app, and therefore it became the natural place where it's at. So we have a, for example, a wallet in the app now where you can see your loyalty points, you can see your any corrections you had from your last your e-com delivery, and you have your digital bank card in there, so you can do all your payments with that. So it's in your wallet, in your app, and well, knowing the Dutch, if your wallet's there, then where you're going to be as well. So it's a fully integral experience. Now, and I think that's, yeah, you can also choose in the app whether you're at that moment thinking about shopping online or you're thinking about going to a store. And what we want to do more and more is change all the interface of the app for you to really cater to your specific needs in that customer journey. So it's yeah, we've really doubled down on that, and it's really fueled both e-com but also in general customer loyalty.
You've got so many opportunities to communicate with your customers through all these channels. How big a challenge is it to know how little, how often, how much consumers, your customers want to be communicated to by you?
And I think that's clearly a question always on the top of our mind. So we have models for that also to make sure that we don't over communicate, but also know what to communicate to who. And that transition we're right in the middle of now to really drive that digital relevance, to have both messaging orchestration, but also content orchestration in terms of who gets to see what. I mean, if you're a vegetarian customer that is a full-on organic, I don't want to show you all sorts of other stuff because, yeah, you're going to be feeling disconnected with me rather than connected with me. And if you're a promotional shopper and always looking for the best buy here and there, I will make sure that I'll bring that to you. And so I don't often like the word personalization too much because it gets and people get into hyper personalization, etc. I always like to talk about relevance and making things more digitally relevant for the user. So, but yes, that's clearly yeah. If you let everybody go loose, then you're going to be overstimulated in your digital interference with us.
One of the things, I don't know if you remember this, but a few years ago we did a publication together with Ahold Delhaize on data ethics with Wouter Kolk, your former European CEO. And one of the themes that came out there was this idea of the personalization of personalization. If you want a hyper personalized experience in which, we're bombarding you with all of the perfect things that you want exactly for you, then tell us, and we'll match your data profile to that. If you want us to leave you alone, also fine, tell us. But this idea of personalization isn't one size fits none, but it's really tailored to whatever you as a consumer want. I thought that was quite a playful and fun idea as well.
Yeah, and I have a lot of conversation with people, and also, I mean, working for the market leader in the Netherlands, and everybody and every birthday and every session privately, also everybody has an opinion and wants to challenge you. And typically people say, yeah, you know all about me. I was like, well, I don't know all about you. We probably hopefully know enough about you to show you and help you and make your experience shopping with us a little bit better than us. So there's no evil story behind that. We're not doing anything strange. We're just showing you if you like certain vegetables more or certain drinks more to show you a little bit more of that. Rather than show you just some general stuff, and it's really I think in the Netherlands people we've got strict GDPR rules because we hold ourselves to the highest standards that we can possibly think of, but we also see that people are very prone to understanding a little bit more about personalization and want to be catered to in their own way, and the discussion has died down quite a lot.
So I think it's one of the advantages of probably your job in that whenever I have a family party or a barbecue and I say to people that I'm a management consultant, their eyes tend to glaze over and they look for somebody else to speak to. With you, I can imagine that's a bit different. One of the much talked about consequences of this digitization is that, in most countries, in most cases, the profitability of grocery has been declining for a good few years. And most of the line items of that P&L don't seem to be pointing in a different way in the future. Hence, this excitement around, retail media, around technology, monetization, etc. I guess two questions. Number one, do you agree with this declining profitability trend? And number two, how much of a pivot do you think these retail media type of enablers will be for the business?
Well, I think in general we've seen, especially in the last years, in general in the grocery market, profitability come down quite a lot, but also because of inflation and wage inflation, etc., and everything that's happening. And nobody in food retail wants to pass everything on to consumers in general because, yeah, you want to stay as affordable and as close to your consumers as you want. I do realize that for example, retail media, and we're quite a front runner in that also in the Netherlands in grocery retail, it really helps unlocking some of the data that you have and some of the opportunities that you have for others to become relevant. Just as we talked about being relevant ourselves, others know that as well. And yeah, we have a front row seat with our customers. Without harassing them with content they don't want to see, but at least be relevant also for other parties. And there's clearly some revenue streams in that that might have gone to different parties, different media, etc. before that now we can tap into. So we've doubled down on that, and we really like what we see there to help us at least to stay as affordable as we can for our customers, and by using those revenue streams also to decrease prices or keep prices affordable. So I do think it's a bit more of a challenging field in general in terms of grocery retail, because there are new revenue streams you need to tap into, or new ways of innovating your assortment and making sure you're not doing the race to the bottom on a limited number of SKUs, but add value added articles that customers are actually willing to pay for a little bit more.
One of the other business models that we've seen some of the big global players talk about more and more is tech. Now, I know that your IT competence for a long time has already been quite engineering based, as opposed to buying off the shelf. With this recent announcement of Walmart to get into commerce, of Tesco to get into trying to sell their tech as well, Lidl, Reva, etc. A lot of the players are doing it. Is that an area that you are pragmatically excited about, or is that something for kind of let's worry about it later?
I'm a little bit on the fence on that, because clearly, we have so many customer facing or employee facing use cases to spend our technology money on, that the use cases that we still have and have in front of us are still really creating a lot of value. So we like spending it on our customers and our employees so far. I do realize that if you got something great in hands, why not share it with somebody else and make some income on that? But it also, to make something marketable to as a software as a service, etc., is different than having it running in your own system, in your own landscape, etc. So it also requires some additional upfront investments that so far we've tended towards developing our own use cases and getting the value out ourselves, but never say never. So that's clearly an area.
And I guess one of the things that we don't talk about in that conversation so much, but which is this shift in culture and capability. I know that you guys have described yourself as a food tech company for a good few years. That's a further step on that journey. But can you maybe share something about the journey that you have been on around the capability and the culture and the leadership side of becoming as digitally savvy as you now are? Because that's been quite a journey, right, from a traditional grocery business.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey. But we call ourselves a food tech company, but we've always taken pride in staying ahead of the curve in terms of technology. So if we look at the in our history, I think we were the first supermarket chain to have self scan in the first place. We were the first to implement the barcode, which is now soon to be replaced by different QR codes and stuff like that. So we always wanted to be ahead of the curve on that. Also, the app, which I talked about, that we had 200,000 users of, we were probably one of the first to launch that app. Then subsequently, we didn't grow much and we didn't invest much in it. But so we always wanted to be at the forefront of deploying new technologies, and we're doing the same thing now behind the scenes with mechanization of our warehouses and the home ship centers, etc. So it's part of our DNA to deploy technology and to stay ahead. I think we really doubled down on it in recent years by embracing the digitalization road. And I think one of the things that guides us there is we never deploy technology for the sake of deploying technology. And I hear that too often. again, in the current hype around generative AI or agentic AI, everybody talks about what's your Gen AI strategy. I was like, I don't have a Gen AI strategy. I have a strategy. And if I can accelerate my strategy and add more value or be better for my customers by deploying AI, we definitely will. But it's always value based and if it's proven, et cetera. So it's really embracing the culture of we want to solve wicked customer problems or wicked employee problems, or we want to create value and then deploying technology. But we don't shy away from doing that and putting the force of our teams behind that. So I think that's part of the journey that we've been on by really embracing anything we see can make a difference. And that makes us a little bit more bold and a little bit more taking some risks and some choices, but it really pays off. I think, for example, the Gen AI, I think clearly we talked about healthy and sustainable, et cetera. One of the things that we saw with Gen AI is like, yeah, what's the number one question everybody's asking is what's for dinner tonight? And everybody puzzles that. I puzzle that privately, and I think everybody does. So what are we going to eat tonight again and make it different? So we see if this is the wicked customer problem and everybody's trying to find ways, whether it's meal kits or whether it's other solutions or recipes, why don't we deploy some generative AI in our app where we have these 5 million users and have a personal assistant? We actually gave him a name recently because it was proven and we wanted to scale up. And we called him Stein from Albert Heijn. So that's a nice rhyme. But and we trained this generative AI assistant fully as a chef. So he knows everything about cooking, knows everything about recipes, knows everything about preparing food. He does nothing about what times the stores are open or anything else. We trained them really around that because we thought, here's where the value is. Here's where customers are really helped with. So you could now ask him questions like, okay, I've got 4 people for dinner tonight. One is vegetarian. One has a gluten allergy. I don't want to be cooking for more than 20 minutes. And make sure there's enough vegetables in there. And you get about 5 recipes to choose from. And by one click of a button, you can put them on your list or in your recipe list or in your shopping list. And you're really helped there. And people are really interacting with the assistant in a way that we've already hoped for, but it's really came to life. So also people asking cooking advice or, okay, how do I cut a pumpkin? What do I do with a pumpkin? How do we prepare that? I mean, we don't know. We don't all know how to cook as well anymore as we did in the past. So also basic sort of utilization questions are being asked. So it's one of those examples where we are quick to couple technology with the wicked opportunities and the problems or the value that we might see. And I think we've really grown into doing that rather than doing old school technology implementations or waterfall projects, et cetera. Start small, learn quick, experiment and scale up if necessary, if we feel that we can make a difference.
I've got to ask, creating this amazing tech-led culture, how difficult has it been to recruit and attract the talent? Because I hear that from so many retailers around the world, and it's such a challenge for retail in any sector. It's always been at the back of the queue, it seems, to be the place that talent wants to go, and particularly as we're seeing so much demand for new tech skills.
I think it's a really, really valid question. And we were at that place and at that dilemma when we started a couple of years ago to really accelerate also in the field of data science and analytics, et cetera. Everybody talks about AI and then implicitly everybody's talking about generative AI or agentic AI nowadays, but 80% of the value is still in data science driven AI and machine learning, et cetera, rather than all the large language models. But when we started that, for example, in 2019, we also centralized all our analytics and data science people working in different departments, et cetera, into one central capability. And we brought them all together and gave them the best data academy we could find. We included partners that helped us train our staff, et cetera. And before you know it, you get a culture of this is the place where you want to work because this is where they train you. This is where they think it's important. This is where I can sit with colleagues that are also have the same sort of interest as I have. And by the way, you're with a grocery retailer that has 4.7 million customers every week across 1,200 stores, 365 days a year. So there's vast amount of data to play with. And before you know it, it really took off. So if I put a junior data science position now live and in our recruitment area. I get 350 applicants within one day, and because everybody knows this is the place to be. Now we weren't there at all at the beginning, so it's a slow process showing that you take it seriously. Really giving people a place where they can grow and grow their talent and skills and responsibility, and then it comes your way. So we were happy that went well, but yeah, we didn't plan that in detail up front. But we really now see that people know that first of all we take it seriously, and second of all, you can make a lot of impact if you work with us because of the number of data, number of customers, and presence in Dutch society.
That's fascinating. Now I understand, we have a student competition at the World Retail Congress. Yeah. This year's challenge was how to recruit Gen Z into the retail workforce, and University of Amsterdam won. So they must have been watching you and learning from you. So.
Yeah, we have a lot of links with all universities, and we do a lot of stuff to basically create the excitement. Actually, next week we have our so-called Food and Tech Week. I give you a sneak preview where we basically. We really celebrate anything to do with technology in that week. So I'll give you an example. In the big hallway where you come into our office, we have a total display of our entire value chain and supply chain. And on every step of the way, we show you what tech and technology is used, that the cucumber is following from the farm all the way to the consumer and any step of the way. And then on the Tuesday, we've sort of invited all the most innovative parties that are there in terms of technology to have an innovation summit where everybody can see what's happening with robotics, still anything that's going on in the value chain there. And we always end up the week with a 24-hour hackathon where about hundreds of people in the technology sphere come and focus on, in this case, customer friction. So we just challenge them, find any customer friction you want and code away, and within 24 hours present your outcome to a multidisciplinary jury, and everybody comes up dressed up. People are staying in the office, sleeping in the office, etc. Just create that vibe and atmosphere. And typically, we don't do the hackathon necessarily to find all great results, but also do some bonding and create an atmosphere around it. But typically one or two ideas of the hackathon have been implemented within a couple of months after that. I give you one example. Last year, one of the parties that won was they deployed, we have the app, as I told you, but they deployed generative AI in our core systems to make sure that we can translate the app to English, for example. So we always had a very Dutch app, and clearly in the Netherlands, many, many people are not necessarily naturally Dutch speakers. So we translated the app by English by deploying these models. And actually, they presented that in our hackathon last year. And a couple of months after, we actually launched it. And we're approaching 100,000 users that are using the app in English language rather than in Dutch language. So it's typically... that's one of those things that comes out, and I didn't think of it, but I thought it would be very difficult translating everything in every different system, but they found a way.
I guess what's really great about that is that I'm really glad sort of that you mentioned Stan, your Gen AI assistant, because it is properly cool. And what this means is that the listeners who don't speak Dutch to this podcast can actually probably use and experiment the app in English. Which I would recommend people do.
I was just going to say, unfortunately, we're going to running rapidly out of time because this conversation could go on for ages. It's great, but Adgood, I'd love to offer you the chance to wrap us up with the last question.
Okay. Yes. So I guess it is clear that the last 10 plus years have been a massive adventure with a huge amount of disruption and change. It's probably fair to say that the next 5 years will be even more dynamic and disruptive. Of all the things that are on the horizon, short, anything that like specifically makes you more passionate or even more excited to see happening in the world of grocery?
Well, generally in the world of grocery, but I think I complained a little by saying everybody talking about Gen AI and agentic AI because the bulk of the value is still in deploying traditional AI and all the varieties of that. But it is a treat to be working in technology and in grocery retail in the times of Gen AI and agentic AI and the speed at which it's developing and the opportunities it will bring at some point. What excites me most is whatever is going to come out of that and the opportunities that come out of that. And I'm always starting with customers, but it's also for many of our colleagues. I really don't see AI as a challenge to workforce in the Netherlands or anywhere else. I see it as an enhancer and making people's job more interesting and enabling them to be of more value add rather than being distracted by things that might not be so much value add. But in the meanwhile, I'm also a little bit anxious on, okay, am I personally able to keep up and read up? Because I'm in meetings, I'm in doing all that stuff. And before you know it, every day there's new news flow. How do we keep ourselves being educated on what's cooking out there and how quickly is it going to go? So the speed of us as people working in grocery retail, having to digest what's going on in technology landscape, that change has been going faster than ever. So that's something to deal with for us all.
It does.
Yeah. We're going to have to invite you back at some point in the future because I'd love to talk to you more about how you see the future unfolding. And it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the World Retail Podcast. Thank you for joining us. I've learned a huge amount about the really deep place role that Albert Heijn plays in the Netherlands for the consumers there. And thank you for joining AdGuild and ourselves on this episode of the World Retail Podcast.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
And thank you, AdGuild.
Absolutely my pleasure as well. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the World Retail Podcast, part of our special series, The Consumer, brought to you in partnership with Deloitte. We hope today's conversation gave you valuable insights into how the consumer is evolving and what this means for your future strategy. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and don't forget to leave us a review. It really helps others find the show. To stay up to date with the latest from the World Retail Congress and to access more exclusive content, visit us at www.worldretailcongress.com and follow us on LinkedIn. We'll be back soon with more thought-provoking discussions from the front lines of retail. Until then, thanks for listening.